Hey everyone, this is Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal, and this is the Fretboard Journal's 93rd podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today I'm going to be talking to Eli West, the Seattle-based musician who continues to astound me with every project he does. He is a truly tasteful acoustic guitar player. He is a great collaborator with Cahalen Morrison. We've done a handful of videos with him over the last couple of years. But to be honest, until this conversation that took place earlier today, I had very little knowledge of just who he was and how he got to where he is. And it was great to hear that because he is a true late bloomer. So anyone who is in their 20s or 30s and think that they are too old for music or their day job has taken over and they can't pursue some artistic projects will want to tune into this because it's a great story. He's got a new record called The Both, which is on Kickstarter right now. And if for no other reason, you should check out his Kickstarter page because there's a truly stunning video that he shot with Bill Frisell, who is on this record at Sage Arts up in just north of Seattle. I think it's up near Arlington, Washington. And you should check that out, but you should also support this record because it is a great record with a lot of great collaborators. And I think you would like it if you're listening to the Fretboard Journal podcast. Before we get to that, a couple of quick notes. We are still processing and taking gift subscriptions and gift orders. If anybody has any last-minute gift needs in 2015, go to fretboardjournal.com. We have 1- and 2-year subscriptions. We have back issues. We have t-shirts. We have tote bags now. So if you have any needs for any loved ones or for yourself, don't forget us. We're still fighting the good fight here and putting out print magazines and loving every minute of it. Speaking of which, we have a new issue off to press. Danny Barnes is on the cover. We are very glad to have him finally getting his due in the magazine. He interviewed Bill Frisell for us back in issue 4 many, many years ago. But it is great to be able to give him the full treatment that he so richly deserves. Before I forget, we have some good news. We have been podcasting for 6 years, almost 7, in one form or another, and I'm happy to say that the Fretboard Journal podcast has a sponsor. Today's podcast sponsorship comes from our friends at D'Addario & Company. If you're looking for the right acoustic guitar strings for your playing, D'Addario strings are the 6 that get you. Art and science, passion and innovation all come to life for unparalleled tone and feel. The 6 deliver that unmistakable connection to the guitar that makes all the difference in the highly personal pursuit of making music. With unmatched playability, unrivaled consistency, and legendary craftsmanship, D'Addario strings can help get you to whatever personal music moment you're chasing. For more information and great exclusive content, you are encouraged to visit acoustic.daddario.com. I know D'Addario was at our Fretboard Summit. We had some prototype strings in our swag bag, and people were flipping out over them. So I am guessing you're going to be seeing a cool press release or two from them around NAMM time with some new releases. Thank you to D'Addario. We're going to keep these podcasts going and growing and sounding better thanks to you. So thanks so much. Without further ado, here's our interview with Eli West. Hey, Eli West.
Hey, Jason. How's it going?
Good. So you have this amazing Kickstarter campaign brewing, but before we get to that, I don't know a whole lot about you and your background. I've seen you play with Cahalen. I've seen you play all sorts of different venues, all sorts of different lineups, but can you talk a little bit about just your music background, where you grew up?
Sure. How far do you want to
just start at the beginning?
Oh, man. Well, I'm from the good old Puget Sound, grew up in Olympia, and I was doing that kind of standard Suzuki kid thing where you, I think at 3.5 years old, you start on this Christmas ornament-sized fiddle that's like 1/64th or something, barely makes any noise. And I did that until about 6th grade, and like most 6th grade kids, boys thought that the guitar was way cooler than the fiddle.
Yeah,
I think it turns out that the fiddle is actually it holds its own
these days. Yeah. It's hard. It's a toss up.
But my genius mother said, "Great, you can do guitar, but you have to treat it just like Suzuki." So I had to basically go and learn classical guitar for my high school years. Which there's plenty of tension pulling you towards, you know, like butt rock and things.
Yeah.
So that commitment was actually challenged, but I think held up and really made me a better player.
And then when did the steel string come into play?
Yeah, that would have been late high school, early college. I went to this house concert. I went to school in Spokane, Washington, or Spokant, as we called it.
Okay.
I went to this house concert that David Greer was playing at, and Matt Flinner, mandolin player, and Todd Phillips. I think I was maybe 17 or 18, and I was excited for the music, but I somehow got beer, so I was mostly excited about being at a house concert at 18 with beer.
Sure.
But then I proceeded to just be blown away by... Greer is amazing, but I was really blown away by Matt Flinner and his playing, so I thought I was going to be a mandolin player. And I do play mandolin, nothing near, that. But the steel string kind of snuck back in. And I went to college as a music major, ended up being a visual art major, which turns out great because all my music major friends are like burned out on music and they're pursuing other careers now.
And you can make your own album covers.
That's true. Yeah, I charge myself a ton of money.
Yeah.
For that.
So how did you... stumble upon a house concert with David Greer at the age of 17 or 18, you'd been listening to a lot of bluegrass or?
Yeah. I mean, I had, by then I had definitely gotten into, like Tony Rice basically.
Yeah.
That was my entrance. and I just, I did stumble upon it. I had a friend who, was a DJ on, KBCS, I think. No, that's over here. KPBX, which is, a Spokane NPR affiliate, and he's always played bluegrass and kind of ended up becoming a mentor in a way for me. His name's Kevin Brown, but so he hosted the show, and I was totally hooked and kind of dug into the whole archive of nerdy guitardom. So
you're kind of a late bloomer in terms of steel string guitar and
and I think
music.
It really shows too. As far as my choices and aesthetic, I can be in an old time jam with a fiddler and I feel like I'm more likely to get the stink eye than anyone else because I want to do like syncopated kind of, more jazz based stuff like inversions, which doesn't really happen in old time music.
Yeah.
I mean, if you find an old time fiddler who will put up with that, it's like the best thing in the world.
Have you found those people?
A few of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, I've actually gained a lot of respect for the folks who are more traditionalists and trying to work on my traditional chops too.
Restraint.
Which, I mean, just as a West Coaster, that's like the challenge, you know, like our whole thing out here is to like, you know, do something with what you find as opposed to recreate.
Yeah.
I think just geographically. So I've thought a lot about that and kind of letting myself own it in a way.
Yeah.
That, I mean, musically, a lot of the players that I respect on the West Coast aren't trying to recreate anything. You know, they're really reinventing or putting a new lens on it.
Yeah. So, did you have much in the way of standard instruction when you wanted to take up the steel string guitar? Or
I guess prior to that, so there was this funny chapter in high school where I was in this volunteer like swing band, like Count Basie style.
Yeah.
Swing band, and I was playing a Stratocaster, which is a little unfitting already, but the band was I think maybe 14 people, and there was a saxophone player who was maybe 12 years old, and then right next to her was this 93-year-old trumpet player.
So this is one of those only in Olympia things.
Yeah, and it was very volunteer and we'd play like, you know, like bat mitzvahs and things like that. You know, it was great.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, in that setting, I learned to read more in a non-classical way, reading charts and just getting a feel for syncopation and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then, you know, honestly, the efficiency and, just the fluidity of, the oral tradition in folk music, was such a relief. I mean, I still read a bit, but I don't have to in a lot of these settings, which is, frankly, like really nice.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's just all ear work.
Yeah.
Which I've gained to, or I've ended up really appreciating. So.
And then you moved back here from Spokane?
Yeah. So I moved to Seattle right after college, and I did 7 years as an interaction designer down in Pioneer Square, like a proper desk job.
Yeah.
And like security and retirement and all that stuff. And then 2008 came, and the firm that I was at was about 32 people down to 16, down to 12. And I made all those cuts. I actually made it down to 9. And then I figured I was next on the block. So right about then met Kahalen, and we made a record, and I was like, I felt like music found me, you know, as far as a professional identity at that point. And
how did you guys meet?
Through that same mutual friend, Kevin Brown, actually. Okay. Yeah. In Spokane. But, yeah, I didn't see it coming at all. And I mean, I didn't look, I'd always played music and played in some bands in Seattle. I never even wanted to like be touring. But I also had this, when I moved to Seattle, I had this really, a lot of security. I bought a house and almost got married, all these really settled things. And then to be able to pull that trigger and be like, oh, I'm going to go run around and sleep on couches and like see a bunch of random towns that I would have no business being in otherwise.
You did it backwards. Like, it's kind of cool though.
Reclaiming some of that post-college stuff. I'm still working on that. I'm ready for the pendulum to swing a little bit back towards security, but I mean, in the meantime, it's really fun and meeting crazy, interesting people. The challenge is that you can never have everyone around a table though. They're just, everyone's scattered and there's a lot of geographic, promiscuity in this business.
Yeah. So what were those early conversations with Kahalen like in terms of where you wanted to go with that duo and, what kind of music you were going to play?
I mean, just by nature of being a duo that kind of confined us to, and being two male voices confined us to, the brother duo tradition, which is great. And I wasn't really that familiar with it. I mean, listen to the Stanley Brothers and the Lubin Brothers and things before, but that wasn't like what got me going. Yeah. So it's more situational that we kind of grew the sound that replicated that, kind of tight interval singing. And, and then we're both weird musicians too. So, and we're both non-traditional, for the most part. So we weren't interested in recreating, but taking that brother duo aesthetic and like doing something new, and it really paid off. I think I'm really proud of the music we've made, and it's terribly different than most things I hear. So
yeah,
that feels pretty good. Sometimes it's a liability, but usually it's an asset.
And then, talk about some of the other, what are some of the other groups that you are kind of,
yeah, right now? Let's see. I spent some time, playing with John Reichman and the Pine Siskins, he's kind of the master of tone, up in Vancouver, BC. I played with Jamie Stone's Lomax project for a bit more than a year.
Yeah.
And, that was really fun. Brought arrangements to the record going through Alan Lomax's, you know, collection of 30,000 songs. And I mean, we probably started with 80 songs and boiled it down, or I was kind of, trying to expand on my knowledge of him, and we got to about 80 and then boiled it down to, I think, 16 or something for the record. But that was really fun. That was a 5-piece, and it was kind of a PAC band, like a performing arts center, very like, formal listening rooms, were a lot of the venues. And that was, you know, I'd been used to playing in either house concerts or bars or festivals. So that was really great. I mean, every note really counts in that setting. And, also just being a 1/5 of a band instead of half, you know, I had to kind of find my role. So that was really fun. And, tons of really talented people in that. I've played with Tony Furtado a bit recently, which has been fun. And just kind of trying on a bunch of different things, playing with a friend, Ben Winship. We just did a Vermont tour, which was great. And and then this solo record, which has been a new territory.
Most ambitious of all. So you have a Kickstarter right now. We're talking in mid-December and 2015. Mm-hmm. Kickstarter goes through, when does it expire?
December 31st.
December 31st. So talk a little bit about it, because it's not a typical, I'm going to make a record.
Sure, yeah. Well, I had a bit of a idea around the body of work, and I'd worked on lots of different arrangements just and thinking of musicians that I'd want to have to paint the arrangement. And I oftentimes had more than one situation or arrangement that I was not ready to let go of both ideas. So and also when I started tracking, my first session was with this gal, Dori Freeman, who you know, she's an amazing singer from Virginia. And we would do everything live, and after the song was over, the take would be like 3 minutes at most. Maybe there's a few that were 2 minutes and 21 seconds or something, which is, even in this genre of music, is pretty short, you know. You know, if that were a Phish song, that would be like the intro, you know.
Yeah.
It's just like really short. So I felt a little frustrated, like, oh, I should have left room for, you know, overdubs or something. But I did want to keep the live feel. So I decided, oh, I could, you know, I could like try and tack on another recording of, the solo, at the end of the song, but then really realized that I already had these arrangement ideas around the instrumentals that were pretty verbose and big. So why not let them stand on their own as a second version of the song?
Yeah.
And then with that kind of approached a few musicians about the idea, and they seemed really keen. So
Dori, who I don't know how many folks listening to this know about her, but she has a record coming out in early 2016 herself.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic record.
Teddy Thompson produced it. I know her through the world of Wayne Henderson guitars. She's played a Henderson for a while. When you guys first went into a studio, you didn't know this concept was coming. Is that right? Or
yeah, well, I still had the ideas of, or had these affinities towards multiple arrangements, but really after that first session with her, I realized that, man, I have a two minute and 21 second song. How am I going to fill this out?
Yeah.
So basically drove away from that session being like, oh, what if I did a whole B-side?
Yeah.
I haven't really seen a lot of records like this, although a great player, Michael Daves in Brooklyn,
is
releasing two records in February, which is kind of the same concept.
Yeah. So. His is one acoustic, one electric, right?
Right, yeah. Like one kind of trad arrangement and then one kind of a more rockin' thing.
So you have Dori on the record, you have Bill Frisell on the record. Mm-hmm. We shared a video, and that's actually your Kickstarter video as well.
Mm-hmm.
Who else is on this record?
So there's this amazing duo of ballad singers, Anna and Elizabeth. Anna is originally from Vermont and Elizabeth from Rural Retreat, Virginia, which is a really cool name for a town in Southern Virginia. And I'm sure folks have heard of them. They're really amazing.
The Scrolls.
Yes, they do the Crankies. Yeah.
Yes, the Crankies.
So that was great. Did two arrangements with them. And then John Reichman came down and played a bit. And then two instrumentals. So that I don't know if I specified, the second half of the record is all instrumental.
Yeah.
Some of it's almost like kind of cinematic feel, like pretty stripped down arrangements of the vocal tunes. And there was two string players I had in mind. Although I hadn't played with them together, I really thought that they could feed off each other. And they had played together in other settings. So Ethan Yoshevitz is a bass player who went to Curtis and lives in Boston now. He plays in Mr. Sun, Daryl Inger's band, and with Sierra Hole, the mandolin player. So I mostly heard him play Arco bass, and it sounds like a cello. I mean, he's up high a lot, and it's just like intonation spot on and really expressive. So he was interested, and then my friend Christian Sadelmeyer, who's a great five-string fiddler from Nashville, plays in a band called the 10-String Symphony and also in Jerry Douglas' bluegrass band. So I asked them, and they were totally game, and it was just the trick of getting everyone in the same place at the same time. So it all said, I think it was four sessions.
Okay.
And seven musicians.
All recording here in the Seattle area?
Yeah, north a bit, up in Arlington at Ed Littlefield's new Sage Studios, which is this fantastic timber frame. I think it's like 15,000 square feet, and our reverb was just a mic on the other side of the room.
Yeah. The video looks pretty incredible.
Yeah, really great space.
So you basically just got to cherry pick kind of people you admired and kind of played with, maybe not.
Yeah, I'd played with most of them. I mean, asking Bill, when he said yes, I was still kind of on the fence of like scheduling. And when Frizzell said, oh yeah, I'll play in the record, I was like, okay, let's schedule this. That was kind of put me over the top. And it's been a while coming, you know, just to put out my first solo thing. And, that was, pretty exciting. He's a really busy guy. So,
you know,
we had to work around his schedule, but it was great. And,
And what did you tell him? Did you tell him anything to bring, like in particular, like a Telecaster or an amp, or you just kind of waited to see what he'd bring?
I knew that he would bring whatever was best appropriate. I sent him demos of the songs, and then also, so a lot of the material is old ballads. So I found original recordings of the ballads to kind of, so he could, you know, get his own interpretation from the original. This one song, Rainbow Midst Life's Willows, is from Granny Riddle, Almeda Riddle is her name. Amazing singer. And so, you know, he listened to that and kind of came with ideas. But it was so pro, he showed up with one amp, one pedal, and one guitar, and plugged it in, didn't turn any knobs, and it was like the perfect tone.
So, yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
I was on the other side twisting every knob and trying to dial it in when he was all set. So kind of, I'm honestly just getting into electric world.
Yeah.
Which has been a little daunting, or I guess a big lap since my high school Strat days, but getting back into that, it's been a guilty pleasure to be able to turn up that loud. And
yeah.
So
what was your gear? I know you're kind of a gear guy. What did you use on this?
So I had a friend in college who was in culinary school when I was at college, and we ate really well. But then that we'd make beer together and things. And then I think he kind of burned out on that earlier. That's just a hard life, cooking.
Yeah.
So he's always been a great woodworker and got into building semi-hollow electric guitars. They're called Songhurst guitars. Danny Songhurst is his name. And he actually built me one guitar that he sent to someone else to do the burst in the Sunburst in Nashville, and his studio actually burned down, so the guitar went with
the guy doing the Sunburst. His studio burned down.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which is like fairly tragic. More for Danny than me, because he'd put all that time into it.
Yeah.
But Danny being a friend, he said, I'll just build you another one. But, songhurstguitars.com. He built one for Paul Allen, and he did like a gold top Les Paul replica for him. And
yeah.
He's definitely into the humbucker world, which I'm actually learning. Single coil is more my style. So I'm going to retrofit or do a coil tap or something just to mellow it out.
And, okay.
Feels a little, humbuckers are just, they're like, there's a whole learning curve on those alone.
Yeah.
You know, they're just loud and sharp. So, I was playing through, he built me a semi-hollow that was loosely based on maybe like a, PRS style or a Languedoc kind of thing.
Okay.
With a tailpiece and all that. And then my friend Fletcher Brock, who has built a few acoustic instruments for me, he's pretty much amazing at whatever he touches. So, he likes the little Walter world of kind of steel amps and, I guess they're based on the Bassman maybe.
Yep.
Like really warm, clean amps. And so he built a combo for me, a year and a half ago, and it's really my favorite.
Fletcher Brock, the same guy who builds gorgeous mandolins and flat tops down in California now.
Yeah, he lives in Carpinteria.
Yep, he's now making amps. For you, at least.
Yeah, I think he's made three or four of them. I don't know how scalable it is. Like, I mean, if you broke down the hourly in the mandolin world, it's like pretty brutal for those guys. Even an $8,000, $9,000 mandolin, you know, it's like pushing minimum wage for the hours that go into it. So, I don't know. Maybe he could scale up amps, and it might be a little more forgiving on the money front. But he just does what he loves, basically.
And yeah.
He does a really good job. So it's a really warm amp, just like a 20 watt small thing.
Yeah.
And you can break it up if you want, but I tend to opt for clean tone. Yeah. And then I had a Strymon Blue Sky that I used really sparingly. And this is a lesson for me too. I mean, just the pedal world, having restraint is such a hard thing. It's like if anyone's learned Photoshop and you find the filters menu, it's like, oh, I can put mosaic on everything and like, you know, go over the top. So I'm still trying to reel it in from the, like just having one or two pedals. So, my standard rig is just that Strymon Blue Sky and then a Keeley compressor. And that's really it.
Yeah.
So, which has been nice to kind of limit myself to that, mostly for the sake of not hauling all that gear around too.
Sure.
It's brutal. You know, people having those big floor mount things and, or pedal boards. So, that was it. And I guess the broader lesson too in the studio is like whatever sound you have coming out of your amp. I mean, that's like writing in stone, you know, cause you could do plenty after it's recorded with, compressors and reverb and all that. But if you're sending it out of your amp, that's it, you know, you can't take it away. So, I was trying to be really, really sparing in that. And honestly, the aesthetic of the record, there's, a few duets with Frizzell that are like, one is just two electric guitars, which is kind of risky because, I mean, you don't see a lot of, electric guitar duets or hear a lot of them. So I tuned way down. I tuned down, I think a step and a half, and then I was in drop. So it was like, what would that be like? Drop B, I guess. And the amp totally held the low end. And I feel like we weren't stepping on each other's toes. We had our own territory. Although, I mean, the goal was to kind of have that back and forth stepping on toes. That's what I love musically, you know, especially in small ensembles. So, and it really worked out. I'm really happy with the tones we got.
And the acoustic guitar you used?
I used four acoustic guitars. So I used one of Wayne Henderson's OMs. Really fantastic, of course. And then I have an old 39 Kalamazoo ladder-braced KG-11 that's like barky and quirky and fun.
Sure.
I think I used that on two tracks. I used a 36 D18 on one track, and then my Fletcher Brock. So Fletcher built me also a Royce Mech copy. That's like a 12-fret J45.
Gotta have him build you an electric and just complete the whole Fletcher Brock circle.
Well, we've talked about that too. I think it's coming.
So with a record like this that's kind of sprawling and has people scattered from around the world, is there any hope for a show where everyone is in the same room at the same time?
I mean, to get everyone together, I think would be a tall order, and that wouldn't really serve the sound of the record because it's, you know, I think a trio at most, maybe there's some quartet stuff, but I think I'm scheduling something mid-February at the Finney Neighborhood Center up on Finney, which is where I live, and it's this great kind of Grange feeling place. Good sounding room. And I'm working on maybe getting Christian and Ethan, who are kind of the string instrumental arrangement guys, together, which, I mean, in truth, I'd be combining the two versions of one song because I'd probably still sing it, but then we could launch into the more cinematic, acoustic or instrumental stuff afterwards. So.
Cool. I wish you luck with it.
Thanks, man.
Folks can check it out. It's called The Both on Kickstarter. Eli West.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Jason.
And everything you touch is a lot of fun. It's right up our alley, so I love it.
Cool. Thanks. Take care.